Her studies at the French Culinary Institute had not prepared Georgia Pellegrini for one of her first tasks in the kitchen of Blue Hill at Stone Barns. The chef asked her to bring him 5 fresh turkeys, but the catch was they were still alive. Surprisingly, she found the experience strangely liberating, and eventually she set off on a year's journey to discover if it is truly possible to live off what you can catch and prepare with your own hands. And she shares stories and recipes from that adventure in her new book, Girl Hunter, Revolutionizing the Way We Eat, One Hunt at a Time. It's published by DeCapo Press, and I'm very pleased it has brought Georgia Pellegrini to our show. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
One of the first things that we learn about you in your book when we look at the cover is that you do not look like what we imagine a hunter to look like. Are seasoned hunters surprised when they learn that you're one of them?
They are. They usually give me a once-over. But after that, you know, they're enthusiastic that so many people are starting to be interested in this kind of, you know, way of living and this way of viewing food.
Well, is this similar in your mind to people who go foraging for vegetables and flowers that they can eat?
It is. I think it's a similar way of viewing the world that we live in, sort of wanting to participate, not just view it at arm's length, you know, participate in the cycle of life, and whether it's vegetable protein or animal protein.
You say that one of your inspirations is Diana, the goddess of the hunt. And you did go to a women's college undergrad.
I did.
Do you see hunting as a feminist activity? What happens when some of your Wellesley classmates meet you and find out that you're doing this?
They think it's great. I think, you know, there's sort of that girl power element to it that I think women are thrilled by. And, you know, I think for me, I think the typical face of the American hunter is a white middle-aged man. And my view is I'm viewing it all through the lens of food. And the fact that I'm a woman and it's a different face for hunting, I think, is exciting and interesting to people.
Well, if you'd been a pioneer woman, nobody would have questioned it.
It's true.
Your college studies prepared you to work on Wall Street, so why did you leave your job at Lehman Brothers?
Well, I'm glad I left because I would have been kicked out eventually. You know, I think the silver lining in doing what makes you unhappy is it forces you to think about what you're doing when you're happiest. And I was not happy, you know, crunching numbers. But I realized I was always happy when I was in the kitchen. I grew up around food and people who love food. And so I just took a leap of faith. I dove headfirst into culinary school.
But then you say that when you got your first restaurant job at Stone Barns, Blue Hill at Stone Barns, you questioned whether or not you had really left Wall Street behind.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, that was one of the considerations at these very high-end restaurants. So much gets wasted in the process of putting these contraptions in the center of oversized white plates in order to conjure a certain amount of money out of people's wallets.
But these are the same people you were working with at Wall Street.
Yeah, I mean, they're the ones who can patronize these sorts of restaurants. And so even though they're farm-to-table restaurants and they compost and they have a holistic view on the process of food, for me, it wasn't really rolling up my sleeves as much as I wanted to. I wasn't really living as sort of off the land the way I wanted to.
So, but you have worked at other pretty famous restaurants, Gramercy Tavern in New York, La Chassagnette in France. But in the book, we see you mostly eating peasant food with people who source food locally because, I guess, out of necessity, not because it's trendy.
Yeah, there is, you know, what's fascinating about this journey that I took is that I met people from all walks of life. In some cases, they were hunting an elk to feed their family for the winter. And then in some cases, they were more stylish, but it was still meaningful to them to live off the best that their hands could produce. And so I realized there's not that big of a gap between the people who go to the farmers market in New York City and those in Wyoming. You know, they still have that same food philosophy, even though they think that they're worlds apart. And I think I'm sort of trying to bring those two worlds together a bit in this book.
But you also argue that hunting your own meat is more humane than getting store-bought.
I think it is. I think you're paying the full karmic price of the meal. And for me as a chef, I loved the idea that I was able to use every part, make sure that nothing got wasted. In these high-end restaurants, so much gets wasted still on the journey to produce something perfect-looking. And when you have to work that hard for your ingredients, you make sure that nothing gets wasted.
Although there's a very famous chef in England who insists on using every part of the animal, from the tail to the
nose
snout.
Nose to tail, yeah. I just ate at his restaurant last week. And I think it's a wonderful philosophy, and it's catching on, which is fantastic. And a lot of these restaurants, you are seeing that.
Well, we see it in a lot of ethnic cuisines.
It's true. It's true. And the markets, some of the farmers' markets and abroad, will show much more than we're willing to show here.
You write that your grandmother confessed to you that her mother used to make squirrel Brunswick because that was the meat that they had access to.
Yeah. I think that was why, I mean, growing up with next to my grandmother and in the same land that my great-grandfather lived on, I really had access to those stories and that sort of view on food. My great-aunt knew the name of every plant on our land. And so sort of that pioneer spirit still existed in my family that I sort of held on to as I got older.
And you actually have a recipe for squirrel Brunswick in the book. Is that your great-grandmother's?
I do. It's my grandmother's with my own little spin. I added acorns to make it a little bit more whimsical, but it's the same idea.
Well, I'm not a hunter, but if I were hunting anything, it would be the squirrels that eat all my tomatoes on my terrace. Is forest squirrel different from the squirrels that you find in Brooklyn backyards?
It is. I mean, you are what you eat. And, you know, squirrels eat acorns. And we're willing to spend $170 a pound for jamón ibérico in Spain, and they feed on acorns. And so squirrels have that nutty, sweet, inherently fatty flavor, which is fantastic. But obviously, if they're hanging out on your New York City fire escape, they're not going to taste the same.
If you're a vegetarian and this conversation is upsetting you, be patient. In our next hour, we'll be talking about vegetarian food. But right now, we're talking to Georgia Pellegrini, whose book, Girl Hunter, Revolutionizing the Way We Eat One Hunt at a Time, is published by DeCapo in the Lifelong imprint. It seems that you had a revelation the moment that you killed your first turkeys from stone barns. Why?
It was hard. It was a moment where I had to really think about my role as an omnivore in this world, as a chef. And I decided that even though it was emotional and intense, I needed to be able to do it if I was going to eat meat in good conscience.
Had anyone told you that killing an animal might be part of the job before you took it?
No. Stone Barns is a very hands-on kind of place. I had grown up fishing my trout for breakfast and foraging, and I grew up with honeybees and chickens. So I always was used to rolling up my sleeves and getting my hands dirty and, you know, butchering during culinary school. But that was the moment that was sort of the transformative watershed moment for me, a switch flipped, and I think it tapped into that natural human instinct that we all once had. We were all once hunter and gatherers.
Well, were you given any tips, or were you expected to figure it out for yourself?
We kind of just did it together. It wasn't just me. It was a few other people that were cooking in the kitchen, and we banded together on the meadow, and there were five broad-breasted whites, and it was very peaceful. It's people sometimes ask me what it's like. It's sort of spiritual. It sounds strange, but you feel like you're participating in the cycle of life.
Well, there are a lot of turkeys at Stone Barns. They in the summertime they sit in the trees. Mm-hmm. At other times they have their in the winter they have their little house. How do you pick the five that are best?
Well, in that case, they were all ready, and so we just chose five. And that's
you're
one
the
of
lucky ones.
Yeah. And that was one of the things I spoke about. I talked about is sort of, you know, we picked five and the other ones were sort of just there watching. And, you know, it's a very interesting primal moment where you realize, you know, humans eat animals and plants. Animals eat plants. Plants feed from the dirt and we all turn to dirt.
And then you went hunting for wild turkeys?
I did. So I decided from there that I really wanted to know what this was about. And I had some friends in the south along the Mississippi River in the Arkansas Delta. They took me on my first hunt, and it was a turkey hunt. So that was an interesting transition into the wild.
So for a while, you were a turkey specialist.
For
when
a
did
short
you start
while.
Branching out into other animals? Because there is a big difference, I would imagine.
Oh, yeah.
Shooting a turkey and shooting something like a boar or a deer or something like that.
There is. And that's what's interesting about hunting is you learn the patterns of animals, you learn the patterns of nature. You smell differently, you hear differently, you see differently, and you sense what their patterns are. You sort of get in tune with their rhythms, which is really an invigorating experience. Turkeys are hard to hunt. They're one of the hardest.
Well, as you were doing this, were you blogging about your hunting trips on your website?
I was, yeah. I've sort of captured my journeys on my blog along the way, photographed, shared recipes, and it's really caught on. People are really responding to it in a way because they're looking for an alternative to our feedlot system.
But also, hunters were inviting you to join them.
That's true as well. Yeah, I've gotten some fun invitations, and every once in a while I'll meet some really interesting, great people along the way.
Although you did have one bad experience you read about with a man who invited you out to Wyoming to hunt elk.
Yeah, I've learned a little bit in this process. I was a little naive and sort of in my enthusiasm. And you realize that ultimately in life, as with hunting, you're guided by your own moral compass. And there's no one really there out in the wild to tell you what's right and wrong other than yourself.
Well, he was a poacher. So how do you find out about that?
Well, I didn't know he was poaching until we were in the moment. And so that's, you know, when you're up 10,000 feet in the mountain with bear signs and a gun and you're on a horse and he's pissed off and the horses are upset, it's tricky to figure out what the best solution is at that moment. Sometimes you just kind of figure out how to keep everyone happy until you get off the mountain.
So did you leave or did you shoot an elk?
I did not shoot an elk. No, I didn't.
On one of your early turkey hunting trips, your hunting partner explained to you that since he started, he no longer had a taste for store-bought meat. Has that happened to you?
It has, yeah.
Well, what's the difference? Does it really taste different?
It's really different. And that's what's exciting as a chef is that each animal is a different culinary adventure because you are what you eat, and they're athletes. They run free. They eat whatever they please. They move wherever they want to. And so the flavors are going to change with every new protein. And with store-bought meat, they live in feedlots. They don't move. They eat the exact same diet as the guy next to them. And so you it's predictable. It's styrofoam-wrapped, plastic-wrapped, boneless, skinless. It's easy to have that anonymous relationship. And, you know, this way it's an adventure. It's a challenge.
So there's no quality control in the wild. Everyone will taste a little different. But they all look different as well. And one of the things you write about, you saw this gorgeous turkey and you decided it would be unsportsmanlike to shoot it?
Yeah, and I think there are moments, you know, these sort of moral dilemmas where you want to make sure you've had to work hard enough. You know, it is a lot of hard work to bring food to the table this way, but you also want to make sure it's fair and you've had to work hard enough. And it was a little too easy at that moment.
Now you have some recipes here, wild turkey and oyster stew, but also balsamic deer heart, beer-battered fried dove breast. Some of the names of those recipes might stop people from ever giving them a taste. You always tell dinner guests in advance that they're about to eat deer heart or fried dove?
Well, one of the things I've enjoyed about these recipes is, you know, I've been able to introduce these veteran hunters to things like deer heart that they never realized they could eat. They just were casting it aside. Of course, in the book, I always give people alternatives. So if you don't have, you know, venison, you can use turkey. So there is ways to alternate and interchange them. But it's an adventure. It's exciting for people. And all of a sudden, they realize it's all mental sometimes, that it actually does taste good.
You had to also butcher these animals. Some people, butchering is an art. You can really mess up something by just cutting it wrong. You also suggest that home chefs age their meat. That means you're going to need some space.
Well, yeah, and I think what's interesting about our meat system is that most of the meat we get is not aged, and it tastes so much better aged. And the reason it's not aged is because it costs money, it costs time, and it costs the loss in water weight. With wild game especially, it's so important to age it because it breaks down the muscle. And what I encourage people to do, even if they buy meat in the grocery store, is to put it in the refrigerator and just let it sit there for an extra 3 days, uncovered, or the more tender cuts can be covered. And if there's any dry bits, you just trim them off.
That's what they do in restaurants.
Absolutely.
Do you have any advice for a listener who might be interested in getting into hunting but doesn't know where to start?
Well, more often than not, people have friends or uncles who are hunters or have hunted. People don't realize it often. I started by going to a trap range where I practiced the feeling of shooting a gun and shooting clay birds. And then I found someone who was really skilled, and they took me with them. You know, and you just start slowly. Start just joining people. You don't have to actually shoot.
And then you have to learn how to break down the animal, to butcher it. And some people might find it easier to kill the animal than to actually do that.
Yeah, I think, you know, whoever you go with often has those skills. There's classes on it, obviously, but you have to be willing to get your hands a little dirty. But I think that we have those instincts, all of us, under the surface, some deeper than others. We were all once part of this process, and it's very invigorating to participate in it again.
Georgia Pellegrini is the author of another book called Food Heroes. She's written for... she's been featured on Iron Chef America, in Food and Wine magazine, Shooting Sportsman, ESPN, and other publications. Her book, Girl Hunter, Revolutionizing the Way We Eat One Hunt at a Time, is published by Lifelong, an imprint of DeCapo. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.